Yeah.
John.
John. So you asked the question, first, like, second question, and I never got back to it. It's just that sense of loving kindness being spread throughout the body. And I just wondered, since I've given instructions the second time here, and kind of talked about it a little bit more, do you have any different questions about it?
Yes, and I also did 30 minutes of walking out here where I really tried to think about the kindness and good feelings and try to feel it as well as think it, and I found that actually kind of works.
Yeah.
I've never tried to incorporate that with walking before, and why it never occurred to me to do that. But,
right. Yeah.
And it's interesting because when I've had lots of those sits where I just can't get out of the aversion, walking gets me out of the aversion.
Right.
So, another tool.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's interesting. I had walking meditation for many years at the very beginning. I had a lot of physical body pain, so it was always difficult to sit. So, like if I had a day or, you know, I'm doing a week long meditation or something like that, easily over half the time on retreat would be walking meditation. So like if I had like 8 hours during the day, 5 hours of that would be walking, and only 3 hours would maybe be sitting. You know, if that was if I could get that many hours in. And so I really experiment a lot. And I heard Lumpur Sumedho kind of give a Dhamma talk once where he was talking about sort of like an emptiness kind of meditation. And he would say like that you're turning around and you're facing your walking path, and he would just note beginning. Just drop that phrase and like that's your intention. You're paying attention to the beginning of the walk. And so you're just sort of watching the intention to start, and then as soon as you move, okay, the beginning. And then just drop it and then go into the silence. And then he'd mark the middle point of his meditation path, and he got to the middle, he would note middle. And then drop that thought and then sort of go into silence. And he's going to get to the end, he'd note ending. And then he'd note the beginning, middle, and end of the turning around. And stop and then wait for the intention to begin again and then note beginning. So I worked with that quite a long time. And I'd say I did also have this, loving kindness practice I was doing in the beginning. And so I just came up with the idea of, I really like that sort of the midpoint, sort of just dropping in the thought, middle. And so I, on my own initiative, I started, what I would do, I was like, walking path would be about the distance in this room here. And what I would do is, we have very specific, like 3 foot wide paths in our forest where they're very delineated for walking meditation. And I would put like a stone or three sticks on the path, one at the midpoint and then one at the 2 quarter points. And so when I just started this meditation where, like I was mentioning, like with the three different phrases, I have completely different feelings for those. So what I would do is I would just start off with the very beginning. I would, that's where I'm really going to come down to one word. And I would just say, safe. And then walk with that feeling for you, like, feel like, four steps, and then I get to the first stone, and I'd say happy, and just pay attention to that feeling as I was walking. So I really started developing, using that as part of the walking meditation, just going through those four phrases, which is four words. And then when I was going through these notes, he just really narrowed it down to just that one phrase, may I be safe or may I be happy. Just one phrase, and choosing that for the entire walking path. And so I was using that, and I found that, it was actually sort of less, just like even just dropping in the four words, there's a little bit of tension in that. You actually are using the mind and things like that. And I just found like on a longer retreat, just to be able to walk for 50 feet without having to bring up any mental activity. Just at the very beginning, just to stay present in the moment. So it just made me happy. And I could have even just narrowed it down to be happy, happy, just to connect with something and just stay with that feeling throughout the whole walking path. And I'm about ready to be even more happy here in just a second. Elizabeth's bringing me some coffee. But then, trying to think, I was going to say something else about that. Maybe the coffee was too good. Elizabeth and I have an ulterior motive here. We're trying to change the perception that coffee is not spiritual. Very really awesome.
When I was looking back at the nine categories of understanding the five through nine or the four quarters in all directions, self, benefactor, neutral people, difficult people, where would you put like family, loved ones?
All of them. Sometimes they actually do. Sometimes those, the benefactor, I could say, sometimes they use my father for that. But for sometimes, he could fall into the enemy category, or, not the enemy, but the difficult person. Or, for some people, we're an adult or a parent might actually always be at a certain point. So it really just depends on your relationship to them. And it's sort of like, it's like staying with the same gender that you are, things like that. It's like some people sort of objecting, well, I want it, for a male, I want to send a message to my mother. But the thing is, we're not sending it. So that's one thing. And that's why I also think it's important to end the meditation with the sharing of merit, because then you actually can, send that merit. It's interesting, we just had this time up, I think I mentioned them earlier, Arjun Dunn was visiting. And we had the monks had a private sort of session with him where we were able to ask him some questions, and somebody asked the question about I forget exactly how the question was asked, but it was something like, he was kind of skeptical about like this metta, or sharing merit, how does that work, it's like something really being transmitted and things like that. And as he was answering the question, he kept referring to merit as metta. He kept, it was being translated, so we weren't sure if the translator was not using the word right or whatever. And so we stopped him and asked him, well, you keep talking about metta, in terms of your answer to merit, is it the same or is it different? Oh no, it's very different. They're not very different. He said it was different. There were different modes. And then I really have to go back and listen to it in more detail, the answer, but I basically remember him kind of saying that with merit, because again, it has to be like someone who's alive, it has to be somebody, who we actually know and things like that. And, I think he said like with merit, it's like or with metta, like it will be received by, you kind of have to take on this on faith, but it's like in the Buddhist cosmology of the whole sphere, there's like 32 different realms of existence. And anybody have a guess or know where human beings, there's 32 different realms. Anybody know where human beings are in that scale?
We're like third to the bottom.
Yeah, we're fifth from the bottom. So there's this four realms that are lower than us, but there's set 27 realms of existence that are more and more blissful than us. And so we're pretty low. But in terms of that, though, the human realm has what they say is that, like, we have an equal opportunity anyway for pleasure and pain. And because of that, there's enough pain to actually motivate us to practice. But there's also enough pleasure or the opportunity. Not everybody has it, but some people, there's enough opportunities for, say, good fortune that we actually can come to days like this. Like, we're not, like at the animal realm, there's just too much dependency on survival. It's like they're always, trying to find food or defend themselves, things like that. So it's too violent of a realm actually to be able to practice. But if you just go one heaven realm higher, then they say it's too blissful. It's just like, we'll go to the meditation retreat after the party's over. And it's just the party never ends. And it's like, each realm keeps getting higher and higher and higher. And so there's just less and less desire to practice. People, beings in those realms can practice and can, but it's just much more difficult. So what this Ajahn Dunn was saying is that with merit, that actually are, metta can be received by like human beings, other human beings, and other, maybe, you know, beings that are in lower states than we are, which would be like animal realms, there's like these hungry ghost realms and hell realms, like people like that can possibly receive the metta. But any being in a higher realm, they can't receive it from us, but they take joy in the fact that human beings are practicing metta, and so they will actually protect you. So it's like even, so they don't receive it directly, but it does make them happy that we're practicing. And then they protect the beings and that are practicing that. So there's benefits to doing it for that reason. But then merit can, from what I've heard this from many different sources, but the merit can actually only be received by beings or who in a particular realm. Like there's only one realm of existence, and it's the hungry ghost realm. So like if, and, many Asian cultures, there's a custom, like when someone's died, to be offering and generosity and merit, and maybe that can be doing a meal offering, like today was done, and then dedicating that to a recently deceased relative. And I always say it's good to dedicate it to that person, but then to all of your past relatives, because going back, at some level, one relative of yours at least is going to be in that realm, in that realm that can receive it, and they will receive it. So that'll be a benefit to them, or just all beings in that realm, so people will receive it. And a lot of this has to be taken on faith, but it's a skillful way. I think I often think things like this is a skillful way of actually just sort of getting out of our own head. Just sort of thinking like you were saying, please leave a little bit of percentage open for other people. This is not all a practice about me, but sort of opening up to other possibilities and realms. And if it doesn't happen, does it work? Or at least we're being generous. At least we're creating happiness for ourselves in that way and being generous. Talk about that though. There's a very interesting story about Ajahn Chah. When he was a younger monk, he had gone off wandering, which is very, very common. And when he was a young monk, I'm guessing this would have been probably in the 1930s or something like this. And he was wandering, and he found this little forest or jungle area. And it was a comfortable walk to the village to get alms, and he was practicing there. And he had been away from his home village for quite a long time at this point. And he got really ill, came down, I think it was malaria, and he came down with this illness, and it got to the point where he couldn't walk, couldn't get up and move, and none of the villagers knew where he was, and even if he hadn't come, for the alms round, they would have just assumed he'd moved on, he'd sort of continued wandering, and so he was there for a few days, and then he saw this, I think it was like a kind of deer it is, but this really tiny, small kind of deer, and it was injured or sick or something, and he kind of watched it as it was dying, and he just sort of realized, that's exactly what's happening to me, I'm coming to the end of my life cycle as well. And he didn't want them to find his sort of like his body parts and with all of his identification with them, and so he didn't want his parents to be sort of disturbed by that. He'd rather them sort of the mystery of whatever happened to him than to know that, this was the bones of your son or whatever. And so he burned all of his identification, sort of destroyed all of it. He was prepared to die. And then one morning he woke up and he was like almost completely fine. He just felt really refreshed and got up and walked into the town and just got a little bit of care and his health returned to normal. And then as soon as he was healthy enough, he decided he hadn't been back to his home village for a while. And he came back, and his parents were shocked that he was alive. They said, oh, we'd given up on you. We thought you hadn't seen you for so long. We thought you were dead. And he's like, when you thought that I was dead, did you go to the temple and, sort of offer merit for me and stuff like that? And he said, yeah, we did. And he's like, he was so struck by how quickly he had recovered that he actually noticed when he got to the village what date it was. He actually found out what date it was. And so he wrote down the date or something or just memorized what it was. And it turns out it was that day was the day that his parents had dedicated the merit to him for his death. So, story. If it's true or not. I just love that, you know, so it actually, it did have this. Well, I told you I do have some stories that would keep you all awake early in the afternoon. The one story I do like telling was just, for me, it's really believe that the metta does have a power and that it does move. I was living at the Kripalu Center, this ashram in Massachusetts, and there was at the time, a lot of people were doing all these sort of experimental kind of yoga therapies on their own. So there was this one called the Phoenix Rising Therapy, and another one called Dance Kinetics or something. So some of the people that were experimenting with these new kind of, you know, inventive kind of yoga therapies. And so those two sort of really, you know, became quite popular. And so other people were sort of experimenting with their own. And this was one person there who was doing something kind of like Reiki therapy. It was just sort of hands-off, sort of body work. And I had done two or three sessions with him and I never felt anything. You know, it was just like, it was at least 20 minutes where I could just sit there and do nothing anyway. So I was always going along with it. And then probably the third or fourth time we were doing it, and we were doing this. And all of a sudden I started feeling this sort of warm, kind of white, it was a white ball of energy just right above my heart and my chest. And he told me, if you ever sense anything or feel anything, just let me know. And so I told him, I said, I got that feeling, this little energy there, and explained it to him. He goes, oh, that's healing energy. You can send that to people. And so, and I remember that my grandmother was going to go in for cancer. She had a surgery the next morning, next day, cancer. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll send this to grandma. And so I was just, you know, sending it. And actually, because I've been doing that to practice, and so I kind of had that sense of what sending it is and feels like. And so I wasn't thinking of it in terms of metta, but I was just thinking of it in terms of this healing energy and sending it. And then that felt really good. It felt, you know, like something I was connecting with grandma. And then I thought, you know, her children are probably kind of worried about this operation as well, so I'll send it to, you know, my mom and my aunts and uncles, and, you know, so I was sending it to their children, and I was doing this, I could feel it, it was moving, and then, without even thinking about it, and I said, and to their children too, which was me, which I didn't think of at the time, I wasn't thinking that at all, I said, and to their children too. And it was like I was standing next to a railroad track, and a train came by about 70 miles an hour. It was like, way more than, like, say, the PT that I jumping. I was like, I was literally just like bouncing. I was literally bouncing off the table. It was like this train was just going right by. And the guy who's doing this, you know, nothing had ever happened to me before, and I'm doing this, and he's just like, continue to breathe, continue to breathe. And I was thinking, is that for me or for him? You know, so, as soon as it kind of subsided, and he was just like, you put a blanket over me and just wait until we all kind of settled down. And he's like, what happened? And I was like, I had time. I couldn't figure it out. And I didn't know either. And then I kind of walked my through it. I said, to my parents and then to their children. I'm like, oh, that was me. So I really do get the sense that when you're sending that, like, I don't think that my grandmother or my siblings or anybody else was sort of like blown away like that. But you know, it probably, you know, had nothing to do with me. It probably had a lot to do with the guy who was doing the Reiki therapy. You know, he probably was opening up some channels or, you know, opening up things, and just came right. And so I was open and receptive to it because of whatever I was doing or living in the ashram. So I really do have a really strong sense that when you're sending when you do send it, that actually something is being transmitted or moving. And the other one I have was a story that's kind of related. Was the very first time I did one of these metta retreats at IMS, the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie. My father was getting ready to go in for a surgery, and I won't get into the details of it, but I really wanted to send him metta. And when I first started doing the retreat, I had all these, you know, sort of like, you know, may you be happy and accept what I'm doing. Those kind of feelings. There's a lot of conditions attached to my loving kindness to him. And you know, I had this insight, which I won't get into, but I had this real insight that really just had a lot of gratitude towards my dad. Came up from this insight that I had. And so when I had this insight, I was able to really send him pure loving kindness. It was about day 6 or 7 of the retreat. And so I spent the rest of the retreat just really being able to connect with him and really wishing him well without sort of, you know, having any sort of conditions attached to it. And when the retreat ended, there was a letter for me in the office. It was from my dad. And at that point, this is pre-email. And so I had never received a letter from my dad before in my life, other than I think a few financial sort of statements or something like that. You know, they'd send me mail, but never a personal letter. And at that point, I was thinking of joining the staff at IMS, and we'd had a discussion about it before I went there. And he was not approving. He didn't say not approving, but he didn't understand why. He basically didn't give me his blessing if he didn't say no. And then when I opened up the letter, he kind of really opened up about some issues in his life, and basically just sort of said, I just want you to be happy. And said, I don't understand your decision, but, I just want you to be happy. And I was like, well, that's really strange. That's just not my dad. What's going on here? And then I was like, well, when did he write this letter? And sure enough, it was the same day that I started sending him loving kindness, really purely. So I was like, is there a connection? But the beautiful thing about the story was Michelle McDonald was one of the teachers, and as soon as I got this letter, I went and showed it to her, and I was like, isn't this great? And stuff. And she goes, yeah, haven't you been listening? Of course it's been happening. She wasn't impressed at all with the story, which really impressed me. She was like, of course it's going to have results. Why are you making such a big deal about it?
I believe it because I had it happen with a house cat.
Yeah.
And we'd lived together for 3 years. She was my then boyfriend, now husband's cat, and she didn't like me one bit. I'd come in between.
Right.
I mean, I'd walk by and she'd hiss at me. This went on for years, and I thought to myself, kitty dearest, and I had all these unkind thoughts. This went on for years, and then one day I just looked at her and I suddenly understood that she couldn't choose to change. Mm-hmm. But I could. Mm-hmm. I could try to see things her way. And in that instant, for the first time ever, she walked over and started purring and rubbing my leg. It's like,
okay,
in that instant, I mean, as soon as I thought, it was like, she can't change, but I can. I can change this relationship by opening to how her reality must be. And then, so it was just, it didn't even take that. It was just, we were right in the room together, but it was instantaneous.
Thank you.
And there was nothing else going on. I mean, I hadn't fed her. She wouldn't take food from me. She was not interested in me at all. So it was pretty interesting.
That's great.
Yeah.
Anybody else having any personal insight?
Energetic.
I'd like to hear if anybody else having experience with food. Yeah.
This is a little different, but I got certified as a hypnotherapist at the U of M. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do it to myself. And I had a list of things I wanted. I wanted a certain kind of job, I wanted a certain kind of boyfriend, certain amount of money, and I visualized, the self-hypnosis every day for 3 months. Within a year, it all came to pass. So I think there is something about putting stuff out there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be asking for things now, necessarily, but more, ease of well-being, maybe become enlightened. I might put that out there. But
great. Yeah, Tom?
This one involves a comment by Ajahn Bhundamo. I didn't hear it. Just as a warning. I was walking down the road in the middle of a snowstorm. We have a... And this is when I lived up in Grand Marais, and we have a road that our association plows, so it's done by a private contractor, and this private contractor's name was Smasher. And so I'm walking in a snowstorm, and I see Smasher coming, and I think, oh, here comes Smasher, he never waves. And then I caught myself with that ill will, and I turned it around, and I said loving kindness to him. And I continued walking, and then he passed by, and then he stopped, backed up, rolled down the window, and had a chat. The first time I've ever had a chat with him. And so Punadamo's comment after that was, he's probably still wondering what happened to him.
That's good. Well, now we're on to stories. I think it's good to sort of, like we're talking about using loving kindness, metta as a meditation practice, and it's just like at the meal offering today, to sort of, it's like And just how, just even offering, you know, food, how that actually can be a meditation practice in and of itself, you know, just the, you know, contemplating, you know, the generosity and how it's actually a support for our meditation practice. It may not, it could be really concentrated and very mindful in the offering, but just how that, having done that, how that can be a support for your practice. Well, actually my initial contact with Common Ground was, after I'd been a monk for 5 years, I had the idea that I wanted to walk from New Orleans to Canada. I was going to basically walk up Highway 61. And so on my way to Thunder Bay, I spent the winter there before I did the walk. And so I came here and visited this center. And that was actually the very first public talk I ever gave. It was a Buddhist monk who was here at Mark's house, actually, Mark and Wynn's house, but to the Common Ground group. And when I started the walk, we started down in New Orleans. The first like 3 or 4 days were just, for me, were just really frightening. It was just sort of like, you know, I looked at it as, you know, I was with a friend who's a lay person, but it was a friend, and I was like, I took on all this responsibility, like I was responsible for his safety as well as my own. You know, like he was basically down there to look after me, and so I felt really responsible for him being there. And so I was like really uptight and kind of nervous about things, and most people had no clue that I was a Buddhist monk. Just, they really had no, just didn't even fit into the world system. And like we discovered for like the first 3 or 4 days, like even if we even mentioned that we were Buddhists, that it would just cut the conversation off. It's just like, it just wasn't in their worldview. And so we were really kind of scared. And then we ended up going up to this, what happened for me was we were walking and we couldn't find any place to stay. We'd kind of gotten off of the first 3 days we'd walked along the levee, which was really kind of nice. And there's always these woods kind of on either side of it. And then we decided we were going to hike on Highway 61. And we didn't realize that there was nothing. It was just swamps on either side of the road for like 15 miles. And so we had to just keep walking. And we finally got to this town and we were looking for a payphone. At that point, we were exhausted. And we thought, okay, we'll call a friend and he was going to come down, pick us up. And then we got there and there was no payphone in the town. The cell phones were all being taken away. And Austin, my friend, went into this grocery store to see if he could, you know, find a payphone inside. And I just sort of did a couple of walks around the store just to make sure there wasn't anything there. And I kept passing this vending machine, which I thought was a Coca-Cola machine or something like that. And I finally stopped and looked at it. And it was a live bait machine. It was all the fishing down there because all the swamp stuff that you put in $2 for the quarters and you could buy a box of crickets, you know, that were alive. And I was just like, you can imagine my whole body is like, I don't want to be in Louisiana. And it was just like, I'm not ready for this. And then, so we decided to skip Louisiana and a friend picked us up and he drove us up to Natchez, Mississippi. And then we hiked along the Natchez Straits Parkway, basically all the way across to Mississippi. And we got dropped off in Mississippi. It was a Sunday morning, so it's like we were driving by all these Pentecostal churches and, you know, the ones with the speaking tongues and all these Baptist churches. We were in the wrong, we're not in the right part of the country. That was like sort of fear of the thought. And we got to this tent, this campground, and got dropped off there. And we decided, like these thunderstorms were coming through, so we decided we'd just stay there for 2 days and just sort of meditate. And at the end of the walk, Austin, the guy I was with, described it really beautifully. He said, we just got dropped off in Mississippi, and he wrote in his journal, I was dressed like this, and he was a lay person, but he took on the 8 precepts, so he shaved his head, and normally wear white robes, but I didn't think that would be kind of appropriate wearing white robes in the South, so I had him wear gray robes. he wore gray robes, so it kind of looked Zen-ish kind of thing, so he was a monastic, he took the 8 precepts, and so he wrote in his journal though, he said, if anybody tells me they have no fear of death, I challenge them to walk through Mississippi the way I'm dressed. that was like how we were feeling. And it turns out later we were kind of way off base on our judgment of people and things like that. But at the time it was really real and the fear was there. And so I was walking through the campground after, between one of the thunderstorms and I was just contemplating just like how afraid I was. And then all of a sudden I remembered, you know, some of the readings of some of the senior monks in our lineage, who, like Ajahn Mun, who's the sort of the kind of the founder of the Thai forest tradition, died in 1950. But he had written that it's like he actually encouraged his monastics to go out into the jungles, into the wilds, because to face their fears. And well, one of his theories was, it's like if you're out in the jungle and you have no protections or anything like that, one thing is your mindfulness will get really strong. You'll be really aware of everything that's around you. You'll start noticing footprints in the ground. You'll start noticing the weather changing. When you need to get to shelter, and you'll start noticing things like water sources. And you start paying attention to way more information than you would before. But also, it's like, well, it's your mind is the only protection you have when you're in the jungle. So it's like, you wouldn't be, you're protecting yourself from panicking. And there's just all these benefits to it, but also concentration. So it's like, there's many stories of where monastics or monks have been out in the forest and got confronted by tigers and just would come up into them. I saw Mark has one of the books called Forest Recollections, and it's in his office. There's a whole chapter in there about encounters with tigers, and there's one where a monk is walking, and he's walking at night, and he has a candle lantern in each hand, and this tiger comes up in front of him and stops about this distance between you are away, and he said its head is like this wide, and he turns around, and there's another one coming up from behind, and he just goes into jhana. His mind just goes completely peaceful, and just standing there, and he kind of comes out of it. He thinks about 2 or 3 hours later, still standing there with the candle lanterns in his hands, but the candles have completely burnt out, and the tigers aren't there. They just saw him and walked, just left him alone. So that concentration is a power or strength in that. I've heard that too. I used to read a lot of like wilderness stuff. I think it was somebody named Brown or something that used to write the book Trackers. Somebody know?
Tom Brown.
And he talks about that too, like when he was once attacked by some wild dogs or something like that, and he was standing there, and then he went into this deep state of concentration, spontaneously. He probably had Native American training, but didn't have the Buddhist meditation training, but he went into this deep state of concentration. And then when he came out of it, the dogs had come up to him, and they circled around him, but they hadn't gotten within a certain distance of him. So this concentration and things like that do have this protective power. So I was doing this, thinking about this, that Ajahn Mun actually sent monks out into the jungle to face their fears, and I was like, wow, that's exactly what I'm doing here. I'm actually doing exactly what Ajahn Mun would have suggested, putting yourself in a dangerous, scary situation just to see how your mind reacts to it. And then as soon as I realized that, I was like, oh, excuse my French here, but shoot, I was like, Ajahn Pasama told me I should be doing loving kindness meditation as my main meditation. He's the abbot of the monastery. He had given me, pretty clear instructions about, how to do it. I already knew how to do it, but just really gave me clear instructions that should be my main theme. And I realized I hadn't been doing that. And so I was like, I got all excited and I ran back and told Austin that and gave him some instructions on how to do it. And then we were there for another, 12 hours in the campground, so we just stayed under our tarps and some big thunderstorms came through, and we just started practicing metta. And then, it was kind of interesting, we were looking at our food supply, because Austin's a lay person, so we can carry food, and I can't as a monk, but we're looking and saying, okay, well, we're going to run out of food today, the next day we're going to run out of food, and we're looking like, okay, there's kind of three towns coming up here about 5-10 miles away, and we'll probably be able to get food there. And then we started walking on the highway, and then I immediately started, usually as a monk, we're encouraged not to be like making eye contact with people, so it's like you should just be looking down, and so I was kind of practicing that way at the beginning, and you know, occasionally, you know, making eye contact with people, not too much. But so we started walking on the highway, and then just as cars were approaching, I would just sort of look up and sort of, you know, just give a gentle wave. People would kind of like, you know, what in the world is that? And they'd see me smiling, and they'd go, well, it can't be too bad. And they'd smile and honk the horn. So we started getting some sort of like, positive new vibes coming back from people. And then we got about 2 miles down the road, and then there was this log cabin. It was like the Natchez Trace Parkway is a national park. And so this was like just one of the cabins they had reserved. It was typical of what the cabins along the way would have been like. And I think like it was used by traders that would come down from Ohio with all, they'd float their wares down the Ohio and Mississippi, and then they'd walk in groups back up to the Midwest. And it was actually an ancient trade route by the Native Americans, probably for about 800 years. It was like this really, really well-worn road. And they'd have these houses about every 20 miles that the people walking up would do. And they had these huge porches, some of them like this size here, and they'd just, you know, for a penny or whatever, people could stay on it. And so we went to look at this place, and it was quite interesting. We started talking to one of the rangers there, and he was like, no, there's no town for 25 miles. It's like, they're on the map, but they don't exist. We're like, okay. So we're figuring out, okay, well, if we walk like, you know, 15 miles a day, and then we'll have to get up real early and try to walk 10 miles to get into the town, it's doable, no big deal. If we don't eat for a day, don't worry about it. You know, we'll survive. And then just then this group of four old guys come up to us and start asking us questions of what we are and stuff like that. It turns out they had a Catholic priest who had just come over from India, and they were kind of showing him the tour sites and stuff like that. And then they were like, hey, do you guys need a ride? And we're like, well, we just skipped all of Louisiana. We might as well. So they gave us a ride up to Port Gibson, Mississippi. And then when we were in the car, they ended up, unloading a bunch of food they had for a picnic and gave all that to Austin and gave him a few dollars. And then as we were getting out of the car, they said, oh, could you give us a blessing chant? And I was like, wow, I think we've only walked 2 miles in Mississippi and we're already, you know, been fed, we're, you know, getting money, and people are asking us for blessing chants, and, you know, this might work. And that was the first day that we were doing loving kindness practice. And every day after that was like almost very similar. You know, like we started receiving this, you know, kindness. And so, you know, I can't say it was like, you know, I did anything special or anything, but it was just that practice. And then one other day, I'm talking about animals, and Austin and I were taking turns of going, asking for water. We had to go up to people's houses and stuff like that. We'd ask for water, and I came up to this. It was my turn, and one of us had always kind of stay way far back. We didn't want to sort of be intimidating, like, you know, sort of proselytizing if they see, you know, group of people or something. Yeah, so we just thought one person at a time going up to the house, and then so it was my turn to go up, and it looked like there were like two or three cars in the driveway. It was kind of a big trailer kind of thing. I go up and knock on the door, and these two huge, vicious dogs come running around the corner and just ready to attack. And it was really interesting. Like, there wasn't any emotion in me at all. I mean, there was a little bit of fear, but it wasn't like overwhelming. And so I don't think I used my hand motion, but it was basically like they're coming around this way, and I sort of like put my hand out and I was just sending them loving kindness. And just like, because I've been doing it at that point for about a week solid. And the dogs came. And the dog that was closest to me, his tail immediately started wagging. Or hers. And started wagging. And the other dog on the other side wasn't having anything to do with it. It still wanted to bite me. But the dog with its tail wagging sort of got its body between me and the other dog. And then they're about the outside of these cushions here. And it forced the other dog all the way around and around the corner of the house. And I was like, okay, thanks. And I got out of there. But you could see the dog was closest to me. It was like it really wanted to come over and, you know, and be with me, but it had a job to do. So it was like, I thought that was just really, really powerful. So it's like, it's interesting. It's like, yeah, the loving kindness has a concentration practice. We're not sending it, but it does have this power. I guess the very first retreat, kind of about this kind of thing about sending, I wouldn't say that that's like, say, universal. Like, you know, it's, I think as a concentration practice, if you are doing like a week long or 3 months or whatever, I think that's a good way of looking at it, is that you just bring somebody into that space, that energy. When I was sitting that first retreat at IMS, I think it was Carol Wilson was also teaching that retreat, and I was in a group interview with her, and I remember this was probably like day 4 or 5, and I just felt like I was going to explode. It was like it was just all this energy was coming, and I really just felt like I was going to explode, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I mentioned it to Carol, and she said, well, send it to people. I was like, oh yeah, of course. And as soon as I did that, then it was, you know, was able to dissipate that energy, and it just felt, you know, much safer. And it was probably like right after that, and I had this insight about my father, so it was like, you know, so there was some real benefit in doing that. And so I wouldn't necessarily, you know, take that as a, you know, if you are getting, you know, extreme energy or something like that, that probably could be a skillful way of doing it. But I think in general, I like this kind of the process of not, you know, really just, you know, holding it internally and building it gently and slowly. Yeah. Let me see. The next thing I wanted to discuss was on this last meditation, I introduced, the benefactor. The next category after that, and this is where I think the next thing will probably be interesting for most people, was that the next category is neutral person. And what these instructions here say is that the neutral person has to be somebody that you know. So if you've ever received the meditation instructions, I know you're going to be familiar with this person. They always tell you the neutral person is the person working at the grocery store, the clerk at the grocery store. Everybody knows this person. But we don't. And so the monk here makes the point that if it's like somebody that we just, that is like neutral, like that we have absolutely no emotion about them at all, it's as if that person is dead. You know, it's like we can't generate the feeling of loving kindness to someone who's passed away. Well, this neutral person, the cashier register, we really know nothing about them. And so there's actually we might as well just completely fabricated the person, you know, from our imagination, like a cartoon character. And for someone with that neutral of a person, we can't, that feeling of kindness for a concentration practice won't be strong enough. It's like that person actually doesn't exist. So what he recommends is that, say like at the monastery where I live, there's usually about 25 or 30 people there, and there's like 20 of us that are full-time sort of residents that live there year in, year out. And, you know, in a group of 20 people, there's always one or two people that are like your best friends, you know, that you always go and you confide things to, that, you know, either your teacher, so that's your benefactor. There's going to be one or two people that you just don't get along with, you know, you don't fight with them and stuff like that, but you just, you know, every time they open their mouth, you think, oh God, here it comes again. You know, so you have the difficult people that you live with, even a group of 20 people. But there's always one or two that, you know, you just, yeah, that's one thing, you don't care about them, but it's just, you know, they don't, if something great happens to them, you think, of course something great, nice happens, and if something bad happens to them, you might feel a little bit of badness, but you don't really feel like you need to run over and console them or anything like that. So there's usually, you know, in any community, you know, of any size, you usually have people that will fit into that category. So it's, you know, the instructions here were to, you know, it should be somebody that you have some familiarity with, you know, that you do know a bit about their story, you do know their name, you do know where they were, you know, where they're born, or, you know, some aspect of them, like what their job is. And that really made a lot of sense. And so when I started doing that during my retreat, it was kind of embarrassing, because you want to kind of come up to someone and say, you know, I'm sending meta to you. You know, so it's like, and you're my neutral person? And all of a sudden you're their negative person, right? But so that was... that I think was really quite fascinating, you know, quite fascinating. And when I did that though, that part of that practice really picked up for me, because like I think I had, it was always difficult for me doing the neutral person, and I think it was just because that same reason, like it basically is, you know, that person was like the equivalent of someone who had passed away or just, you know, just sending it to nothing. So that was really, really helpful. Now the fourth stage is the difficult person, and of course that's the most difficult person to send it to. In this case, you know, some people just don't have people, you know, that they just don't have somebody who's, you know, they actually have issues with or difficulties. And the instructions here are that you don't need to create somebody. You know, you don't have But actually, if you don't have anybody that's neutral, like some people, they just naturally just do. You always have a reaction to somebody. You know, it's either positive or negative, and it's really hard to say that you have a neutral person. And that's okay then. So this, you know, what category do they fit into? You know, and we don't need to create categories that don't exist. But I think, you know, most often are, yeah, I mean, that might be the case, but there are some people that I've met that just don't feel like they really have anybody strongly, that they just have aversion towards. And so if that's the case for you, yeah.
Well, where do your loved ones fit in? Because there's yourself, there's
yeah.
the sort of teachers,
yeah.
mentors. Neutral and then negative.
Mm-hmm.
Where can you feel positive?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that. It's like when I did it through IMS, I think they actually do have a fifth category, which would be that, you know, the loved one. So I think it's probably okay to just to have a category for that. I wasn't practicing that way this fall, but I think that always was a little thing in the back of my mind. I think that'd be fine. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody asked me this question. I was down in Rochester, sort of giving this a very similar, I was talking just about that very first aspect of this morning about the aversion towards metta. And, I guess it was actually this morning. It's like, you know, I didn't really worry about if I actually got everybody, you know, in all the categories in there, or if I was, you know, only sending it to myself just for a period of time. Because I actually do see these as categories of, you know, say progressively more and more difficult to do. And so it's like, it's really learning just to be with that feeling within yourself and then just including more and more beings into it. And so if it helps you, I think, to, you know, have that intermediate stage of like loved ones or friends or something like that, I think that's perfectly fine to do. It might be that this monk maybe didn't include that in there, because with say, like a loved one or something like that, it's, you know, there's much more tendency to get attached to them. And so that would be, potentially a danger there. You know, even if it's, you know, somebody that you're not sexually attracted to, but they're, you know, if it's like a, you know, like a sister or somebody like that, that, you know, it's like it's pretty easy to get attached to that, or our best friend or something, you know, like that.
It could just get caught up in
the drama of it all.
Emotions, feelings, and things.
Exactly. Yeah.
When the second time we were sitting this morning, this is after lunch.
Yeah.
I was really feeling the difference between that sending feeling, which seemed to be where I automatically wanted to go, you know, because I'm saying that my use of the language and things, you know, put it out, and then I could pull it back in, and it's more like, okay, this is like when you're learning to sing. If you want to project your voice, what you do is you make your voice very full in here.
Yeah.
You don't try to send it that way.
Yeah.
You make it here. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be a... And that was a really different feeling.
Yeah. It,
with the meditation.
Very different feeling, yeah. That's a great analogy. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I was
going to
say, I think most of us have learned to do the dear friend, and I don't know if there was a category for loved ones, but I find that loved ones and hated ones all move around.
Yes.
So I can have a loved one in the most difficult, or I can have it in the very best. So it doesn't have to be, you know, the same person in the same place all the time. I don't think that's pretty obvious, but I just thought I'd throw that out because mine move around a lot.
It's really interesting when you end up in all four categories as well.
Yeah.
Not for me, but you. Yeah,
I find often when I do the loved one category, like just a bunch of people show up because I love a lot of people, and it's like, there's so many of you, and I just don't want to pick one of you.
Right.
And then I start feeling kind of overwhelmed, and so then I stop doing that.
Yeah, actually I've had that experience too, like when I did that. Yeah, especially, yeah, friends. I was like, well, which one are we going to do? And that's interesting, too, is that, I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but say another thing, too, is like when you sit down for, a 45-minute period, that's what, you know, he recommends, you know, doing, be at least 45 minutes, and it can be more than that too. As you see, I'm doing shorter just because I wanted to spend more time talking about it. But for each session that you sit down to do these categories, say like we don't need to go through all four of them or get into all beings, but just go as far as, you know, say if you have been, you know, getting all the way to the difficult person, but then for whatever reason, that condition that day, you can't even really get the generation for yourself, and it's just to stay with wherever it is that you can connect with the feeling. And then when you do start, say, doing the benefactor, or in this case, if you wanted to do the friends, wherever we get, there can be a tendency, like you just brought up, it's like, so you're doing Mary, and you're really connecting with Mary, and then all of a sudden, oh, I want to do it to Sally, so you switch and start doing Sally. It's really important to stay with just one person for that entire sit. So it's like, if you start with doing, you know, your best friend, and stick with her that time, and the next time you can do your second best friend, you can stick with her the whole time. But it's if you keep shifting around, because there is this, I'm getting that there's this sense that the generation, you know, the power, you know, the energy that comes from it, and it is this real connection with another human being. You know, there is that there, and so, you know, if you you have that feeling of metta going, and you start shifting people around, it's just too scattered to really, you know, keep that energy going. But it's okay. So like if, you know, like this that you do Sally, and the next one you could do Mary if you wanted to, the next one you could do, you know, whoever. But it's okay to shift around that way. But for just one sit, stick with the same person. And it would be the same thing. So like if you're going through, you know, if you are able to get up to the fourth stage, but then you lose it, and then they say to go back to stage one and develop it again. Each time you come for that sit, even though you've gone out of that stage, then you're coming back up through it again, still use the same person. And then for the next set, you can do differently. Any other?
Yeah, I was thinking about the neutral person and how it should be something else, but I've had an experience so many times where I look at just like a clerk at the co-op or something, mm-hmm. and after I do that to my neutral person for a while, I walk in there and they're just, they are fabulous. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know anything about them.
Right.
But like I do distant healing, that's part of my livelihood, and yeah. I can send it to people that I don't even know anything about them.
Right.
I hear, oh yeah, they're super expensive.
I don't think that you couldn't do it for that kind of person, but I think it's for, because we're trying to do it for the, let's say the easiest to, so that's like typically in Asian cultures anyway, that's why they start with themselves. And, you know, and then just to get that feeling going, then you go on to the different categories. And so I think for most people that, because you're a professional. So, but for most people, I think just having someone that's just, it's basically kind of, unless you, I mean, you could have some people who are, I mean, there's probably a lot of artists in Minnesota and in this area. So like someone who does have a very good imagination or, you know, it's good with music or physical, being creative. They probably can, you know, create somebody that's lifelike enough or something like that. But I think for the average person, I think it's just too abstract. Someone that you've just seen one time. And it's like the analogy that the monk in here gives is sort of like if you're living in a monastery and you have a guest come, instead of using the co-op clerk, they use the guest who's just arrived at the monastery. It's like, you know nothing about them. They might even be gone tomorrow. You know, stuff like that. You know, he would say that he would use something, like if someone new did come to the monastery and they were completely neutral, you know, at that point, he would at least go up to them, find out, you know, if he was a monk, you know, like, well, what's your name? Where have you practiced before? You know, where's your home monastery? You know, how long have you been a monk? Just has a little bit of information about that person. It wouldn't have to be much. But he did say too, like if that, you know, if you start doing the metta to that person in affection, or, you know, they actually do change into the, you know, the dear person, stuff like that, that's fine, but then you just can't use them as the neutral person anymore. So now they have to have another, you have to have your dear one, or it comes into the friend category, something like that, which is fine. The other thing too about this, I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier already, but it's like if you, when you do the four categories, it's like, I think I did, it's like, once you've developed, you know, all four of those, you know, I did, so it's like, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, like, you know, like if you were on a pirate ship and you had to, you know, pick out one person to jump the plank, you know, it's like, who's that going to be? If you're, you know, at a certain point that the difficult person, you know, there's no ill will towards that person. You know, so it's like, they still would be a difficult person. Like, you would know that they would, you know, that character, those traits are still there. It's not, it's, I think that's another experiment. You know, it's one of the reasons I think there's some misunderstanding about metta. It's like, it's not actually like loving that person. You know, it's like, I don't like that. You know, it's not saying that you have to love this person, but it's just, I just don't have ill will towards them. You know, it's like there are characteristics or traits or, you know, if I'm around that person, it brings out, can bring out the negative, you know, aspect or just even that I said that this person is an unskillful person. And they do things that are unskillful that we disapprove of. So it's not actually approving of all of their activities, but it's just not having a will towards them. And that's kind of also where the equanimity comes in. So like the difficult person, if it is somebody who has, you know, just, you know, activities or person, parts about their characteristic that are abusive, you know, it's just not condoning that. So it's a, I need to have equanimity. It's like you will help change that person when you can and if you can. But if you can't, then it's just not having the will towards them.
I think kind of the poor Brahma, the hardest the part that's the hardest with metta is my sense of self is by far the strongest. And so, like when I'm doing it for myself, you know, may this mind be at ease, may this body be strong. Mm-hmm. But because you're connecting so much, at least for me, more than I do with the others, I'm always really aware of the sense of me. Mm-hmm. Unless you're, you know, and once you go into concentration, it's gone, but, you know, for that one part, and it's really sweet, but it almost seems to have a sense of self that seems almost contradictory to other parts of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think in that sense, it's like, you know, it's a, like I say, not all desire is unskillful. So like not all senses of self ultimately that's not gonna, you know, that's not, you know, that particular sense of self isn't gonna lead to enlightenment, but it is a path to, you know, it's like using desire in a skillful way to get you to the result. So it's like it's a skillful way of using self. Because then it will, you know, if you do then really connect with them, if it does lead to concentration, then it does naturally fall away. So you just have to look at it, and it's like, but if it reinforces or, you know, leads in a negative way, then, you know, like, okay, well, something's not quite right with it, then you need to make some adjustments.
I think, you know, I think what it has helped me to do is to really feel emotion stronger, which was something coming from a good Scandinavian background.
You know, don't feel.
To do.
Yeah.
I can relate to that a lot because I've had that experience, I feel like, lots. And more recently, what's been really helping me in that sense is remembering or like just opening to the reality that metta is not something that I generate or that like I have to do something to create, that metta is everywhere already in all of us and all around anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been more like a practicing of kind of like allowing it to flow more rather than sort of needing to generate it. And so
yeah, that's really important because, yeah, we actually aren't creating it. That's kind of the, I haven't really talked about much about that, but because you just keep coming back that it is just an intention. It's actually all, you know, it's like, it's interesting in the Metta Sutta, you know, the Buddha's words on loving kindness. They actually, in the Pali, the word metta only comes up one time in the entire sutta. And, you know, and there it's like, when he defines it, it's just non-ill will. You know, that's the only time it's phrased, and so it's like, it's not that the feeling is actually a byproduct, and that's actually knowing that you're there, and so it's like, that's why I say, like, it is metta, because it's, you know it's there because of that, but actually, in a sense, it's actually not, it's just that intention to wish well.
And I think Sharon Salzberg makes a clear distinction of that. I, you know, she's saying this is not magical thinking. Mm-hmm. You know that. Because it's real easy to get there.
Yeah, like some of the stories that I told, it's like, wow, you can get really totally involved in that. The other thing is Monte Gooderopter makes the same point that, you know, it's like it's not this magical thing. And I was listening to him, well, what about that time when that freight train almost ran me over, you know, when I was, you know, sending goodwill to my grandmother. It's like, that seemed pretty magical to me. And I mentioned that Dutch impossible to my teacher. He goes, no, that's not magical thinking, that's just reality. I forget how he phrases it, so I'll have to delete that. But basically it was like, no, it's like, he's talking about magical, you know, Sharon Salzberg talking about magical. It's like, you know, it's kind of like, it's the way I take it anyway, is it's sort of like, the sort of belief if we do, then that, if we get into that state and then we're sending, you know, then we're going to have these effects in the world and then we're going to start creating magical results and things like that. Well, that's, you know, that's beyond our scope. All we can do is be aware of that feeling and bring our attention to it and to bring our attention to want to be aware of that feeling. Because if we're not creating it, it's already there. You know, just bring it more and more and more into our consciousness. It's like one person may have said, like when you go to a movie and watching the movie, it's like, you know, you can go into the movie theater and never once be aware that you're watching a screen. You know, so it's like the screen's always there. And so it is always there. The breath is always there. You know, whatever meditation object you want to use, it is always there. So it's learning to see that and to have that as your primary object. Yeah.
I still have trouble connecting with kind of the really simple, basic feeling of metta, because I really confused the rapture for it for like quite a while.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to see the subtle thing instead of the big,
right?
You know.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah. So that it can just take some time. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, if you've been used to somebody recently just telling me, like, you know, like with drug addiction and stuff like that, it's like, you know, like there's normally sort of like, you know, you described it, but like there's this normal sort of sense of like a little stream flowing. And then when you take a drug, it's like you get Niagara Falls. And as soon as you stop Niagara Falls, it's like maybe that feeling of stream is there, but you're not going to notice it just because like you got used to Niagara Falls. So it's almost the same thing. It's like, okay, we got to turn that Niagara Falls off. And then, not turn it off, but just pay attention back to the stream. It's like, not Niagara Falls, if you're paying attention to the stream continually, if the Niagara Falls can be there, but you don't, you still don't lose that sense of the, so as soon as you brought that up, I'm already hearing the Nada sound again. It's gone away, but then it's back again. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, I mean, I know what you're saying, I've had the bliss out stuff, and I, you know, send it in all four quarters, and when I send it in four quarters, metta and loving kindness and compassion, all this, I view it going around the earth, and I always get a thump in the opposite side whenever it comes back around. If I sent it from my back, I get a thump in my chest. Mm-hmm. So I think the energetic is flowing, but instead of the bliss out, I mean, it's still been one of the most powerful metta direct things I've ever had was, I was at Common Ground at the old place to do metta, and I went downstairs to get the teacups, which were covered on a basket and covered with a cloth, and I pulled off the cloth and I look into this teacup when I got upstairs, and there was this huge centipede, and it was standing up in the cup trying to get out, and from my angle, I saw it doing this, its body doing this. I think they're the grossest things on the planet, you know. I would have wished every centipede dead up until that moment, but I've been doing metta, and I was there to do metta, so I was already in that kind of space. And it suddenly occurred to me that it valued its life as much as I value my own. It's trying to get out of the cup. And I picked up the cup, and I was totally revolted, and I walked back down to the basement and threw it. You know, it's like, to me, that was metta. I was not blissing out, but I could not harm that creature, which I was so revolted by. And it was just a real interesting teaching that I do not like you one bit, but I do not want to hurt you. You know, up to then, you know, up until a year or two before, I would have just smacked that sucker, you know. So it was a real different kind of feeling. Like, okay, you're in the world, go be in the world.
Just not.
I won't hurt you. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not necessarily this loving feeling. Like, oh, I love you. I love you.
No, it wasn't like that at all. Why did I have? Why did this happen to me? But it was just not gonna hurt you.
But I guess other things kind of comes to mind too about the, you know, just that subtle feeling is, you know, it's like, because I say it is the three aspects. So it is just the intention to sort of wish yourself well. And that's basically where it is. You know, start, if you're starting with yourself or whoever you're connecting with, so it's just that intention. And then again, it's the phrases. You can't really stress enough that it's doing the phrases. And so if that's as far as the meditation goes, like even for, you know, so 40 minutes or 45 minutes, if you're able to just, you know, 100% of the time, you know, be with just that intention and being with the phrases, and even if nothing arises, that's really good practice. I mean, that's exceptional practice to be able to just to be with your mindfulness. Your mindfulness is really strong at that point. And it's sort of like so most of the time, as I just did this 3-month retreat, there were some times when I was really, really strongly connected with the practice. And I remember at one point, concentration practice really hadn't been a big focus of me for most of my monastic life. It's more like just mindfulness practice or just learning not to kill the other monks. You know, that was good enough kind of practice for me and stuff like that. Asking for forgiveness all the time, that kind of practice. And so I was having some really good results from the practice. And I remember sometimes it sort of was like I couldn't wait for the practice. And then not the meditation to be over, but like later in the evening I'd be walking up and I'd run into the abbot. And I was just like, I ran into him one time. I was really anxious to tell him about what was happening with my meditation practice. And I said, it was like the second or third day in a row. And I said, I know you're getting bored of hearing me, you know, talk about what's happening in my practice right now. I said, but you know, I had so little success before. I just want you to feel mudita. So there were some times I was really, really connecting with it. But other times that, you know, I wasn't. And it was interesting, like before I think I would have gotten upset, you know, that I wasn't getting the results. But I just knew that it's like, it doesn't matter because I'm putting in the conditions and the results. So I think that's more important, is not to worry. I mean, because I think you probably have a sense of what that is, what that feeling feels like. And so it's like, when it does come up, you'll know it. And I think that's the big thing about all of this practice, is that we don't really need to be like second guessing ourselves or, you know, kind of worrying about any of it. Because I think, you know, just the fact that you're here and that you're interested, I think there's something in all of our hearts that actually does know, that actually does have a sense of that. And so, like what happened during the retreat, like I was reading these notes, and the monk was, the Thai monk was really stressing that, you know, like once you start doing the loving kindness practice, this monk was like really wanting to go in and do sort of investigation practice. That one, the novice who was writing to him, really wanted to get into sort of investigating, you know, like what's the cause of this sort of feeling arising and stuff like that. You know, and the teacher kept saying, no, it's like, you know, just stick with the feeling of metta, you know, just don't be doing that sort of thing. And there's one or two sort of questions that he was responding to, and he basically said, once you start getting going, don't go back to the equanimity practice. You do it at the very beginning, but don't go back to just doing the equanimity practice. It's a full-time practice, because it's a completely different kind of practice than doing a lot of kinds of practice. You're developing something different. I was reading that, but then at a certain point, my meditation got really, really kind of dry for like about a week. And there was something in me that just sort of, you know, said, you know, no, I actually should be going back. And just, you know, it's like, hey, you've gotten too dry. It's like, I really just should go back to just bring the mind back to being concentrated. You know, it's something really simple. And so I went and talked to the abbot, and I didn't even tell him that was what was happening. And he just sort of said, just trust your mind. You know, that was the abbot's advice to me, just trust your mind. So I went back, and I ended up just spending, I was thinking about going back for a week and, you know, doing, but I just ended up doing it for 3 days. And then the mind immediately started connected with the object again. So it's like, it was just, you know, paying attention to my own, there was just this deep inner sense of that's what I should be doing. And I think it's important to, you know, if you're doing a longer retreat like that, to have a teacher. So like I did, I just didn't just do it on my own. I kind of checked what these notes were saying, because I was using these primarily, and it was kind of hinting against that, so I kind of went with that for a while, and just, no, I don't think that's right. So then I checked it out with, you know, a live teacher, and then he was like, yeah, trust yourself, and then have them, you know, pay attention to the results. And I talked to the teacher about that, and I told him the whole thing. He was like, yeah, that's right. So I think it's not to worry about that you're not connecting with it right now. You will if you keep putting in the causes. Mm-hmm.